So we're looking this morning then at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 3-13. And we saw last time then in verses 1 and 2 of Hebrews 12 that the Christian life is hard. The writer there likens it to a race, and he doesn't mean there some kind of little fun run at the school sports day. He's talking about a long, grueling sort of race. He's emphasizing that the Christian life is difficult and demanding. And in the passage then that we're looking at this morning, he very much continues in the same vein. The word race doesn't actually appear again, but we do have three phrases which continue that athletic analogy, and they're stark and sobering phrases. Gone now is the rousing slogan, "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." The writer's more gritty and more frank in the athletic language he uses now. So verse 3, "Do not grow weary or faint-hearted." Again, verse 5, "Don't be weary." And then you go down to verse 12, "And lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees." So it's the same idea of the Christian life as a race. He's continuing this athletic analogy, but you get a sense now that these readers are struggling participants in this race. They're flagging. They look like they could collapse at any moment and stop running. That is to say, they look like their faith could dry up and they could stop being Christians. Now, we explored last time a few reasons why the Christian life is hard. And as we move into these verses, I think the writer has in mind one particular reason why the Christian life is hard, namely opposition. Opposition. He mentions in verse 4 the possibility of shedding blood. And that almost certainly then is a reference to martyrdom, which of course is the ultimate form of opposition. So hostility, antagonism, opposition. He's assuming that that's one way that the Christian life is hard, and that that's one very significant factor then behind this weariness, this fatigue that is threatening to end the race for these readers. So here they are then, and they're finding the Christian life hard. And they're finding it hard not least because of opposition. Fatigue is setting in. And they're being called by this writer to fight that fatigue and not to succumb to it and not to stop running. But how are they to do that? How are they to overcome this weariness that they're feeling and the opposition then that is causing that weariness? Well, in this passage, the writer tells them. Actually, he's already told them. Remember back in verse 2, we identified there, didn't we, two mechanisms by which these readers were to run with endurance. They were to do it on the one hand, contemplating Jesus, and they were to do it on the other hand, contemplating joy. Those were the two mechanisms that he provided there. And here, as he instructs them, as he exhorts them now to fight this fatigue, this weariness, he actually reiterates the same two mechanisms and also one additional one. So that leaves us conveniently this morning with three points that our writer is making, two expanded reiterations of what he's already said in verse 2, and then one additional point as well. So let's look at those in turn. So our first heading this morning, fight the fatigue looking backwards to the founder. Fight the fatigue looking backwards to the founder. This is verses 3 and 4. And this is the first point then that he's making. And as I say then, this is a reiteration of what he's already said really back in verse 2. It's the contemplating Jesus bit. Remember he said in verse 2, look to Jesus, the founder of our faith, who endured the cross. And now in similar terms in verse 3, he says, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself. Now we need to probe then what the writer means by this. How exactly does he expect his readers to benefit from considering Jesus? How exactly does he expect that to help them in fighting the fatigue and keeping going in the face of opposition? How precisely does he envisage this working? Well, let's first of all eliminate a couple of things that I think he's not doing. I don't think he's saying here, look at Jesus and be inspired. Look at Jesus and be inspired. Now, it's true, of course, that Jesus is an inspiring model for us as we run the Christian race. And that's how I applied verse 2 a fortnight ago. Because in verse 2, the writer goes to town, doesn't he, on the impressiveness of Jesus' endurance, the way that he despised the shame and endured the cross. And so we're meant to think there in verse 2 of Jesus in the midst of his passion, to think of him in Gethsemane and in the high priest's residence and before Pilate and at Golgotha, harassed and beleaguered and yet undeviating in his resolve. And we're meant to be stirred and we're meant to say, wow, I want to be like that in my Christian life. So I'm saying there's definitely a place for looking at Jesus and being inspired. But here, now, in our passage, he doesn't really go to town on the impressiveness of Jesus' endurance. He actually moves very quickly from mentioning Jesus in verse 3 to mention his readers in verse 4. I don't think here he's trying to enthuse them and get their persevering juices flowing by simply holding before them the finest ever example of endurance. Nor do I think he's saying, look at Jesus and be grateful. In other words, look at Jesus and be grateful that you'll never have to endure what he had to endure. Now again, there's a profound sense, of course, in which that is true. We said last time that part of the shame of the cross for Jesus was his bearing our guilt before God. And of course, the whole point of him bearing our guilt before God was that we should never have to bear our guilt before God. There is this profound substitutionary dimension to the cross. He wasn't simply doing something with us or alongside us. He was doing something for us instead of us in our place. So it's definitely appropriate to look at Jesus and be grateful. And certainly in verse 4, the writer does distinguish what Jesus endured on the one hand with what his readers have endured on the other hand. He resisted to the point of shedding blood. They haven't resisted to the point of shedding blood. They've suffered humiliation and they've suffered imprisonment, it seems from verse 10, and they've suffered the confiscation of some of their possessions, verse 10 indicates, but they haven't shed their blood. So the writer does distinguish between what Jesus endured and what they have endured. But before we make too much of that distinction, notice the crucial word in verse 4. Yet. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, which clearly suggests that they could do at some point in the future. It's not beyond the realms of possibility that they could at some point follow Jesus down the route of brutal death. So he can't be saying then, look at Jesus and be grateful that you'll never have to endure what he endured, because he uses that word yet and he suggests that they may have to endure what he endured. So, if he's not saying then, look at Jesus and be inspired, and he's not saying look at Jesus and be grateful, what is he saying here in verses 3 and 4? Well, I think he's saying this. Look at Jesus and be realistic. Look at Jesus and be realistic. He's saying, here you are, you readers of mine, and you're facing some opposition because you're Christians. And it's wearying you so that some of you are really hobbling along there in the Christian race. Well, what did you expect? What did you expect? Our faith has a founder, a trailblazer, a forerunner, a prototype, one who has run this race before us and has reached the finish line and received his eternal inheritance, and in whose footsteps we are following. Inevitably, his experiences, therefore, must be our experiences. His experience of opposition must be our experience. And actually, the writer's saying, viewed from that perspective, the opposition you've faced so far is strangely modest. For some reason, all you've had to put up with is humiliation, imprisonment, and the confiscation of your property. You haven't yet resisted to the point of shedding blood, like the founder of our faith resisted to the point of shedding blood. So don't crumble, he's saying, with weariness because of some opposition. At conversion, you signed up to follow in the footsteps of Jesus the crucified. You can't therefore really expect anything less than crucifixion. Anything less than the shedding of your blood. Look at Jesus, he's saying, and be realistic. So that, I think, is what our writer means. Now, of course, we all love, don't we, Hebrews 4:15. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet without sin. And rightly, we love that text, and that strikes an important note. And sometimes then, when we're finding the toil of the Christian life overwhelming, we need to hear that, don't we? We need to hear there's a sympathetic high priest in heaven who's tender and understanding. He knows how we're feeling, and his heart goes out to us as we feel so overwhelmed. Sometimes that's what we need to hear. But perhaps there are other times when we need to hear this. What did you expect? What did you expect? I guess for most of us in the West, Bonhoeffer's famous words probably hardly resonate with us at all. You know his great phrase that when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. When Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. But that's right, isn't it? It's only echoing what Jesus himself said on several occasions. Take up your cross. You and I were converted in order to take up a cross and follow Jesus to Calvary. We were converted in order to end up bloody, brutalized martyrs like him. And here we are this morning, and it hasn't yet happened. And we haven't yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. And we've no real reason then to feel overwhelmed by difficulties of a more ordinary kind. I mean, if you sign up for the 100-meter sprint in an athletics contest, then 20 miles later, you're entitled to say, look, I'm stopping because this is too exhausting. But if, on the other hand, you signed up to run a marathon at an athletics contest, then you can't really say 20 miles later, well, I'm stopping because this is too exhausting. It's what you signed up for. What did you expect? And so that's, I think, what the writer is getting at in verses 3 and 4. He's saying, you Christians who signed up to follow Jesus, you shouldn't be weary and faint-hearted at this point when you're still so far short of that thing that you signed up to. Still so far short of the violent death that Jesus experienced. So fight the fatigue, looking backwards to the founder. Don't tolerate premature, unwarranted exhaustion. Be realistic. Look at Jesus, the founder of our faith. So that's the first point that our writer's making. But then secondly this morning, fight the fatigue looking forwards to the future. Fight the fatigue looking forwards to the future. And this is verses 5 to 11. And this is the second point then that he's making. And again, this is a reiteration, essentially, of what he said in verse 2. This is the contemplating joy bit. Remember, that was the second mechanism we identified 2 weeks ago. We saw in verse 2 that for Jesus, there was a joy set before him. And we said that by extension, there's also a joy set before us. And verses 5 to 11 now are encouraging us to think further along those lines, to set our eyes on the prospect that awaits us beyond the present opposition that we're facing. Actually, the word joy is used again. It doesn't feature in the ESV translation, but in verse 11, it literally says, "For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than a joy." And so it's the same word from verse 2. But also, there are three other ways in which the writer now describes the prospect that awaits us beyond present opposition. So he describes it as life. Verse 9, second half of the verse, "Shall we not much more be subject to the Father spirits and live?" And I think he's probably referring there to the same life he's described back in chapter 11, verse 35, resurrection life in the world to come. So he describes our prospect as life. He describes it as holiness. Verse 10. "They disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness." Extraordinary thought. That one day we are going to be like God. Like God in his very holiness. It's almost as though God is going to take that deceitful promise of the serpent to Eve in the Garden of Eden. "Eat this and you shall be like God." And God is so emphatically going to defeat Satan that in the end that promise will actually come true for his people. And we will be like God. We will share in God's holiness. So life, holiness, and then a third way our future is described, righteousness in verse 11. The last time we had the word righteousness, it was about Noah in chapter 11, verse 7. And we said that Noah was an heir of righteousness. It's not talking about justification by faith there. It's talking about that world to come, which Peter says righteousness will dwell there. We're heading for a realm, an order that's dominated by righteousness. And that's probably what the writer's referring to again here in verse 11. So in these three ways then, life, holiness, righteousness, the writer is pointing us to our eternal future, this prospect that lies beyond the opposition. But there's a further dimension to this that we need to grapple with. Because the writer then, he isn't simply saying this. He isn't simply saying, okay, you've got to face opposition for a while, but then that will eventually give way to this glorious future, so let the thought of that glorious future stave off the weariness and the fatigue. That would be a legitimate and reasonable point, but he's saying more than that here. He's saying that this present opposition that we now face, it won't simply be replaced by a glorious future that's going to burst in one day. He's saying the present opposition is actually helping to bring about and to ensure that glorious future. Now, where do I get that from? Well, notice that throughout these verses, verses 5 to 11, the opposition that they're facing is redefined, isn't it? It's no longer described as hostility, that was the word he used in verse 3. It's no longer described in terms of shedding of blood, that was the phrase he used in verse 4. Instead, he uses one word consistently throughout verses 5 to 11. Discipline. The opposition that they're facing is redefined here as discipline. Now, what do you think of when you read that then? I suspect many of us, when we come to this passage and we read this word discipline, we think of chastisement. We think of God's corrective punishment, his fatherly corrective punishment. Yes, it's different from his judicial punishment that is hell, that was exhausted for us on the cross when Jesus died there. But this is God's fatherly corrective chastising punishments. And certainly the New Testament points to that reality, doesn't it? We were talking about this at Time Out on Tuesday evening. We have a couple of passages which indicate this kind of thing. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where some of the Corinthians are ill, some of them even have died. And Paul indicates that that is God's fatherly correction and chastisement because of the way that they are abusing the Lord's Supper. And then James chapter 5, the passage we were looking at on Tuesday night, there too, James indicates that sometimes in the case of illness, there can be a sinful cause, and it is God, therefore, chastising and correctively punishing. But I don't think that's what's in view here in Hebrews chapter 12. Now, admittedly, in the quotation from Proverbs there in verse 6, we do have the word chastises. So Solomon had that kind of divine discipline in mind. But I don't think it's that word chastises which has really attracted the writer of Hebrews to those two verses from Proverbs. I think it's other things that have attracted him to that quotation. The mention of discipline, for one thing. The fact that discipline is motivated by God's love. And the fact that, supremely, that we shouldn't grow weary under it. So I think those are the things that have attracted our writer to Proverbs chapter 3, verses 11 and 12. And I think then that he's happy to quote those verses from Proverbs, even though Solomon's additional reference to chastisement doesn't apply in the Hebrews context. Certainly it would be unusual, wouldn't it, for opposition from the world, from the unbelieving community, for opposition to be reckoned as chastisement. Illness, yes, as I've said, there are a couple of New Testament precedents for that, but it would be unusual for opposition from the unbelieving world to be reckoned as God's chastisements. Now you might be thinking at this point, well, what other kind of divine discipline then is there? If it's not chastisement, what is it? Well, you'll notice that throughout the passage there's this analogy, isn't there, with earthly family life. So think about that for a moment. Think about that realm, the realm of earthly family life. And yes, in that realm, that there is chastisement sometimes takes place. But isn't there also, in the normal, healthily functioning family, isn't there also a more pervasive form of discipline that's always going on? I mean, think about it. A young person, left to him or herself, will probably get out of bed about halfway through the morning at least, will never wash a dish or contribute in any meaningful way to the smooth running of the household, will leave their bedroom as a bomb site, and will choose every time to play and lounge rather than do homework and practice useful skills. So what do you do as a parent? Well, you fill that young person's life with routines and responsibilities and deadlines, a time when they must get out of bed by, and a quota of dishes that they must wash, and regular bedroom inspections, and inviolable slots for homework, and practicing useful skills, and all the rest of it. And all of those things then, to some degree, they impose upon that young person, and they encumber that young person, they constrict that young person, and they conflict with that young person's inclinations. They're all forms of discipline. It's not punishment, it's not chastisement, but they're all forms of discipline. And I think it's along those lines that we should understand the word here in Hebrews chapter 12. The writer is saying that these readers of his, left to themselves, they would have chosen an easy Christian life. But God wasn't letting them have that easy Christian life that they would have chosen. Instead, he's filling their lives with opposition. And like then the earthly parents' imposition of chores and timetables, this divine imposition of persecution is a form of discipline. So that's the first thing we need to understand here, that this opposition they are facing, it's being redefined as discipline. Now, let's take this a stage further. Discipline, then, is good, isn't it? Discipline is positive. It's good to be an object of discipline. How is it good to be an object of discipline? Well, our writer says, first of all, in verses 7 and 8, it's good because it verifies the relationship between you and the one imposing the discipline. So, to return to my illustration, if you're that young person and you're having all those chores laid on you by your parents, it's thus made very clear to you that those two people, or that one person laying those chores on you, are your parents. Other adults, you know, don't give you all those chores, and nor do your parents give other children those chores. But the fact that they're giving them to you makes it very clear that they are your parents. And the writer says it's the same with this divine discipline. Those great words of verse 7, God is treating you as sons. He doesn't treat those who aren't his children in this way. And those who are his children don't get treated by others in this way. But God has treated you as sons. But then there's another reason he goes on to explore in verses 9 to 11. And this is the really key one. Why is it good to be an object of this kind of discipline? Yes, because it verifies the relationship between you and the one imposing the discipline. But more importantly, because discipline is productive. It produces something. It has an outcome. Again, you see, if you're that young person and you're having those chores and responsibilities laid upon you by your parents, it's not because they are sadistic and they just want to make your life harder for the sake of it. It's because they want you to develop as a mature and responsible adult, and they know that the best way of that happening is by you engaging in these things that they're laying upon you. And again, it's the same then with this divine discipline. It's productive. It has positive outcomes. That's made very clear in verses 10 and 11, isn't it? Verse 10, they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them. That's the earthly parents. But he, that's God, disciplines us for our good in order that we may share his holiness. And then verse 11, for the moment all discipline seems painful rather than a joy, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So he's saying then that this opposition that these Christians are presently facing, it's not simply going to be replaced one day by this great eternal inheritance, life, and holiness and righteousness. No, in some sense, the opposition is actually producing that. It's working towards that. It's this productive discipline that God is laying upon their lives. How? How could this opposition that these readers were facing, how could that be actually ensuring that they will one day experience that eternal inheritance? Well, perhaps this is how. Because this opposition was smashing away the idols in their lives, which otherwise would have taken over and would have diverted them completely from the Christian life, so that they would never have received the eternal inheritance. I mentioned already that one of the things they had faced was the confiscation of their possessions. Mentioned in chapter 10. It's clearly an issue, possessions, for these readers, because he'll come back to it in chapter 13 about the love of money. And perhaps that then was a potential idol for these people. It's a potential idol for all of us. Perhaps it was a potential idol for these people that could have taken over and could have diverted them off the race altogether, so that they would never have experienced the eternal inheritance. And the opposition comes. And it smashes that idol. Their possessions that they were tempted to idolize are taken away from them. And so that opposition is indirectly bringing about that eternal future for which they're heading. And so I hope you see the logic here. The writer is saying, fight the fatigue. Don't let this opposition wear you down until you stop running. Fight it, looking forward to this great future beyond the opposition. And knowing that actually the opposition is itself preparing in a sense and producing in a sense that future for which you're heading. And it's not just actually opposition, is it? It's any kind of suffering we could apply this to. Paul says, in very similar language, in 2 Corinthians 4:17, that our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. It's the same concept, isn't it? The troubles are actually achieving for us the eternal glory. No, of course, he's not replacing Christ. Christ supremely achieves for us the eternal glory. But again, it's this point, surely, that if it weren't for the troubles, we might not persevere. And if we don't persevere, we won't receive the eternal glory. And so we can apply it to opposition. We can apply it to any of our struggles this morning. These things are actually productive discipline. God laying these things on our lives because through them, we will persevere. And we will receive our eternal inheritance. So fight the fatigue, recognizing the purposefulness of these struggles and difficulties that now we face. But then, one last thing this morning. Fight the fatigue, looking backwards to the founder, yes. Looking forwards to the future, yes. But fight the fatigue, looking outwards to the frailest. Fight the fatigue, looking outwards to the frailest. And this is verses 12 and 13. And this is the additional point then that wasn't there in verse 2. And he says, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet. So keep going, keep on running. Why? So that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. What on earth is he talking about there? Well, I think the lame that he mentions there are probably a sector of the church, of the congregation to which he's writing. There are a group of people that he has in mind within that church. He's thinking there of the very frailest. I mean, I don't mean the frailest physically, I mean the frailest in the Christian life. Those who seem closest actually to collapsing and to prematurely finishing, not making it to the finish line. And his point then is that you who are not yet quite at that point, if you keep running hard, if you strengthen your knees, lift your drooping hands, that by example will spur them on to not stop and to keep putting one foot in front of another and to keep going. So that they, and in our version it says, so that they'll not be put out of joint. But actually the word that the writer uses there, it's a word which four times in the two letters to Timothy, Paul uses of apostasy, of wandering away altogether. And I think that's what he means here. Here are these frail believers, and they're in danger of wandering away altogether. But if you keep going, and if you provide them with that inspiring example, then perhaps they'll keep going as well, and they'll not wander away, and instead they'll be healed. It's like what he said back in chapter 10, isn't it? Those well-known words in verse 24 and 25. Let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. And so he's saying to us this morning that you have a responsibility to keep running, not only for yourself and for your own sake, for the sake of others in the church, brothers and sisters in Christ, who may be flagging even more than you are, but who will be strengthened when they see you keeping going. Because it does work like that, doesn't it? It works like that actually with physical running. It's a strange thing running, the way in which you pay money, or some pay money, to join a running club. And what are you paying for? You're paying to kind of go out running on the streets of the city where you live, which you could do for free anyway. Now, you do get some other benefits, but that's the main thing you're paying for, to just go out running when you could do that anyway for free. So why do people do it? They do it because they know it's much easier to run with others. Because when you're running on your own, mentally, you get down and you get down and you think, I just can't go on anymore. But when you're running with others, you start to feel like that, but then you see them and you want to keep up with them. And so you want to keep going like they're keeping going. That's how it works with physical running. That's how it works in the Christian life as well. That we're spurred on by one another. And so to stop running is personally disastrous. But it's also letting down your brothers and sisters who need you to keep running so that they'll keep running. And so this morning, if we are feeling weary and faint-hearted, let's fight the fatigue. Fight it by looking back to Jesus and being realistic. What did we expect when we signed up to be Christians? Fight it by looking forward to our eternal future and recognizing that the very things that are making us weary are things which are working towards that eternal future. And let's fight it looking outwards to the frailest, who need us to be strong for them so that they can be strong. Amen.